This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the space where in 28 minutes, people with genuine expertise explain to people without, that's you and me, folks, what they need to know about a big issue of the day. This week, post-pandemic unemployment. In Britain right now, it's likely that between a third and a half of the working age population isn't actually working at all. Millions of us are furloughed, paid while we can't work, but that scheme is due to stop later this year. As the furloughs end, we'll see a surge in unemployment. So today, I want to know how bad it's likely to be and for whom, what lessons can we learn from history, and what could the government do about it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, some history. The coronavirus pandemic may be unprecedented, but crises leading to high unemployment are not. What can past recessions tell us about our work-deprived future? Melanie Sims is Professor of Work and Employment at the University of Glasgow.
If we look at periods of increasing unemployment in the recent past in the UK, there's two that are particularly interesting. One is immediately after the financial crisis in 2008, and the other was in the 1980s. I was at school during those periods of very, very high unemployment in the 1980s, and I was fascinated even then by thinking about, well, what makes someone more or less likely to be unemployed? It was always presented as a really scary thing in the public discourse. My grandparents lived in Coventry, which was being really badly hit during those times. It was also, of course, a time when the miners were on strike as well.
How long do you think you have to stay out?
As long as it takes.
I did understand, even as a sort of 12-year-old, that they were on strike because they didn't want to lose their jobs and they didn't want to lose their industry. All the periods of mass unemployment look very, very different from each other. So if we think about the 1980s, for example, there was a really fundamental restructuring of the economy going on, away from manufacturing and towards service work. And that gets kind of illustrated in popular culture through things like TV shows like Boys from the Black Stuff.
Give us a job. Go on, give us it. Give us a go, go on. I could do that.
And that was an outcome of quite a deliberate set of decisions by the then governments. And it was also a function of just changes in technology that were happening in manufacturing. So manufacturing was becoming a more capital-intensive, robot-intensive, automated process that just didn't need as many labourers. That kind of restructuring of the economy disproportionately affected upper working-class men, so working-class men but who were in good jobs. That was the sort of shape of the 1980s recession in employment terms. At the same time, we had the decline of the mining industry and the printing industry and all the industrial conflict that went with that.
The once prosperous West Midlands has suffered sorely during the recession.
Unemployment in the 1980s went to about, at its worst point, about 12% of the workforce.
After years of affluence, the region's factories lie empty. Many of them have been stripped of all their machinery.
Because it was specific to particular sectors, and those sectors were more commonly found in particular regional areas, those regional areas were badly affected. So if you think about the Midlands, which was very dependent on car manufacturing, any regions that were particularly dependent on mining, those kinds of jobs were hit very, very badly. And what we see now, if we look at those regions, is that they're still struggling, some of them.
So I thought I'd better learn a trade. At school, I used to get in trouble for taking computers to bits.
If the classic sort of image of the 1980s recession was perhaps a printer who was having to change industry entirely, then at the same time, we actually also had really quite an uptick of youth unemployment.
I'm on a YTS, employed by GEC Avionics.
And some of the youth training schemes that were developed in that time became quite famously problematic.
I'd heard things about YTS, but it's given me a start. And now I'm on the payroll like everybody else.
One of them was called the Youth Training Scheme, YTS. And there was a view that it was kind of artificially placing young workers with employers, and it was often a bad match for both of them.
They say the dole figures are going down. Why? Because they're all getting stuck on YTS.
YTS schemes, that's it. Well, getting stuck on them.
2008 was different because we didn't see big numbers of companies going bankrupt. We saw a few and they were very high profile, but we didn't see the kind of big real world effects.
For the brightest and best in banking, it was a day they thought they'd never see, when they'd be on the street looking for work en masse as their employer, Lehman Brothers, filed for bankruptcy protection.
So those images of workers leaving the big financial institutions that famously collapsed, that wasn't typical of what happened in employment terms. And if you think about those workers leaving those high-skill, often quite well-paid jobs in financial services, they have quite a lot of choices in a way that a 19-year-old with A-levels, for example, often wouldn't. So the 2008 crisis only got to about 8% unemployment. I say only, and of course that hides lots of stories of, you know, real distress, but that extra unemployment was almost entirely accounted for by young people. A big part of the crisis was that companies couldn't borrow any money to invest in their future at that point. So the companies, they weren't shrinking, but also they weren't hiring new people. So the young workers really struggled in that time. One of the things that happens is that if normally they'd be looking at A-level students, because the graduates would be going into different graduate jobs, but now there's some availability of graduates, they may well take the graduates instead of the A-level students. And that works its way all the way down the labour market. So the people who are the worst affected are the people either without qualifications or with very few qualifications. It's a really hard question to look back at the past and then try and predict the future. It's a very dangerous game, and academics tend to really not like doing that. But we've got a number of things that we do know tend to happen in crises. And so one of the things is that the people with the least skills or in the lowest skilled jobs tend to suffer the most. That's often young workers starting to build up their skills and experience. They find it harder to find jobs. And even if they're not unemployed, they sometimes find themselves cycling in and out of employment.
Melanie Sims. Back to the here and now. What do we know about the who, where and what of employment in Britain as of June 2020? And what can we expect in the very near future? Laura Gardner is Research Director at the Resolution Foundation, a think tank focusing on people on lower incomes.
The data at the moment presents a bit of a conundrum. So if we start by looking at unemployment, the rate is currently 3.9% for February to April. That's very low. It hasn't really risen. Of course, that's a three-month figure that only contains really 1 month of the lockdown period. Why is that? Well, there's a few reasons. Firstly, we've had a job retention scheme that's been very successful at keeping furloughed workers attached to jobs. And there seem to be quite a few other workers and self-employed people who aren't currently doing any work, but are saying they still have a job that they're attached to and might go back to. So they're not registering as unemployed in the data. The second big reason is that those who are losing jobs are showing up not in unemployment, but in something called economic inactivity. To be unemployed, you have to be looking for work and available to start that work. And with very few vacancies in the economy and benefit work search requirements not in operation at the moment, it seems that people aren't fitting that technical definition of unemployment and so showing up elsewhere in the worklessness stats.
So that just feels like the situation now, and particularly the situation as it will shortly be revealed to us, is disguised. For example, how many workers are on furloughs?
The current estimate is a very large number, around 8 or 9 million workers on furlough or that have been furloughed at some point over the past couple of months. There have also been very big increases in claims for universal credit and other benefits. Now, some of those have been by working families, so it's not all about unemployment and job loss. But I think it's right to look at other data. Government schemes are supporting a vastly larger number of families of people in the UK with the economic effects of this crisis on jobs, pay and hours worked.
That's what, about one in four workers are on furlough or job retention schemes. But we don't know how many of those will actually be going back to jobs at the point where the furlough schemes end.
That's a really important point. So the Chancellor has set out a path for winding up the job retention scheme, which is pretty cautious, but does require, for example, employers to start making contributions in August. We would, I think, definitely expect a large number or a significant minority of workers on that scheme, particularly those in the really hard hit sectors like hospitality and leisure, to be made redundant. So although we haven't seen a big increase in the unemployment rate yet, I think we should be preparing for a second wave of unemployment as the furlough scheme is wound up through the late summer and autumn.
Where do we expect it to bite worst, regionally, sectorally, and in terms of demographics?
The answer to that question relates to the fact that this is an incredibly sectoral crisis. Unsurprisingly, the lockdown has affected sectors like hospitality, non-food retail and arts and leisure much more than others. And these sectors will continue to be affected by ongoing social distancing requirements in the medium term. So it's the workers in these sectors that have been most affected, most likely to lose jobs or be furloughed. And they are also particularly likely to be the youngest or the oldest workers, and particularly likely to be lower paid workers. And that's quite different to the previous crisis, where it was actually sectors like finance and construction that took the hit, not particularly low paid. When it comes to the question of where in the country, things are actually quite spread out. And that's because hospitality, retail, arts and leisure, they are everywhere. So jobs are being lost and workers are being affected across the country. There are some more acute challenges in sectors heavily reliant on tourism, places like Cumbria, Blackpool, parts of Cornwall and Devon. But in general, this crisis is having quite dispersed regional effects, particularly compared to some previous crises like the one in the 1980s, where the industrial change was incredibly concentrated in some regions of the country.
It's clearer to me why younger workers might be affected by this than why older workers would be. Can you take me through that?
The youngest and the very oldest workers are most likely to work in atypical forms of work, like 0 hours contracts, temporary work, agency work. And these have been particularly affected in the crisis.
Quite a lot of the sectors that you're talking about are sectors which can grow and contract quite quickly. I mean, is it not the case then that we might easily expect those sectors which have been badly hit just to bounce back?
The sectors that are hardest hit are quite high turnover and tend to bounce back. But I think the fundamental challenge is that there are real limits on how much those sectors can do in the kind of new semi-normal phase before we have a vaccine or effective treatment. So ongoing social distancing means there's only so many tables you can have in restaurants, there's only so many people you can have in pubs. So these sectors may be agile, but they are just facing these hard supply restrictions that are going to make them less profitable, less productive, and without government support, severely constrained and likely to shed jobs.
Many of these sectors offer people, in a sense, their first jobs, and jobs in such a way as to get them into the labour market and acting as a platform for what they then go on to do. So what happens to young people when those platforms are taken away?
There's been a lot of research on what happened in past recessions, and we now know that periods of unemployment or leaving education and entering work at a time when it's weak scar young people. What scarring means is that in their pay and their employment prospects many years down the line, those are likely to be lower than compared to similar looking people who weren't long-term unemployed or who left education in better times. So it's those long-term effects that I'm really, really worried about.
Why does that happen?
Pay and jobs improvements tend to happen very quickly when you're young. If you essentially have that kind of initial fast growth, fast improvement pulled out from under your feet, it gets tougher to do it and to do it as quickly later on. And in addition, we know that the longer people are unemployed and the longer people are out of work, the tougher it gets to search for work, the more employers look unfavorably on them, the more disaffected they might get. And that happening right at the start of your career, again, seems to be particularly bad.
I'm going to ask you to do the impossible, really, which is to try and predict what levels you think we're going to see.
The Office for Budget Responsibility, the government's forecaster, expects unemployment to peak around 10%, and the Bank of England expects something similar, I think around 9%. A much higher level of unemployment than in at least the previous two crises, so that's a really serious challenge. And my particular concern is not so much that level, although that's really worrying. It's that because of the particular challenges of this crisis and ongoing social distancing and the type of people losing jobs, we shouldn't be overly optimistic about how quickly that can come down. So let's worry about how high it's going to go, but let's also be really concerned about the pace with which we can get people back out of unemployment. And I think that latter challenge is where policymakers should be really focused in the coming months.
Laura Gardner. We've covered the past, analysed the present and can see what the problem is. Time now for the future. Alan Manning is a Professor of Economics at the London School of Economics and has spent his career studying jobs, wages and unemployment. And Tony Wilson is Director of the Institute for Employment Studies and has worked for the Department of Work and Pensions, Job Centre Plus and the Treasury.
I think we need to reduce labour costs, primarily by reducing employer national insurance in the short run, particularly over the summer, so that employers have a bit more breathing space to keep people in work. And then looking further ahead, I think we need to make sure that we've got the capacity and the investment in our employment services, in our skills and training services, and potentially looking at things like job guarantees and job creation programmes, so that people who are out of work are getting immediate help to prepare for work and then find new jobs.
Now, I suppose I want to know from both of you what the balance of this should be. Should I mostly be urging that we do things to keep people in their existing jobs? Or should I be saying, well, now's an opportunity to encourage job creation in sectors I do want to encourage and I do want to see people go into in the future?
I think this is the hardest decision you've got, because protecting people in jobs right now is expensive compared with what is often lighter touch and less expensive support to help people find new jobs, where the economy is creating those jobs. It's got really significant risks that you're paying for economic activity or for jobs that would have been maintained anyway. So there's these sort of deadweight risks, which is a horrible phrase, but if you've only got a limited amount of money, then the better you can target that, then the better impact you'll have.
Alan.
I think it's also really important that the government just does what it can to maintain the general level of demand in the economy. And so they're not specifically seeking to create jobs in this sector or that sector. Mm. They're just seeking to keep the level of demand up. And when people spend their money, then they will be creating jobs in those sectors wherever they happen to be spending their money. And I think income support for people who are not in work is really important. That obviously as individuals, households, they're having big cuts to their income, making their life very hard. But if they cut back on their expenditure, then that expenditure is someone else's income. And the worry is that you get these job losses cascading through the economy. But we are in a situation where the level of benefits that are provided are actually extremely low and, have become lower over the past 10 years. And so I think there will be more pressure to actually make that slightly more generous. It helps out not just the people who are in dire financial states individually, but they're very likely to spend the extra income. That would be a very good policy for the government to actually make universal credit more generous. They've made it slightly more generous, but they could go further.
So it's important to remember that we have at least a two-pronged approach. One is to support people who are going to be unemployed, not just for their own sake, but for the sake of the economy more generally. And then there's the question of what kind of jobs they are going to get and are going to be created for future employees. And I suppose I want to know what those sectors could conceivably be.
It's really, really hard to pick winners, let alone to identify losers. And governments always struggle to do this at a kind of industrial or a sectoral level. And the economy creates jobs all of the time and all across industries and sectors. And it will return more quickly if we can restore confidence, control the virus, get businesses sort of reopening again. And then I think it's about how we can intervene sort of sensibly in sectors where we know there's going to be demand, where we know it's going to create particularly entry-level jobs that people who are unemployed would be able to get into, and then lining up, for example, the pre-employment training skills to help them get those jobs. Clearly, social care and health are areas that are still creating a lot of jobs, and they account for about 1/5 of the jobs being advertised right now. And a lot of those are jobs that people could move into relatively quickly with the right training and support. I think also, you know, a lot of people have said that things like the whole green agenda, green jobs, but in particular things like home energy efficiency, is again something where we could create a lot of jobs relatively quickly. And those jobs would be where people live. I mean, you know, the real benefits of doing things like insulating homes is it happens all over the country. And actually often the housing stock needs more investment in places that are relatively more disadvantaged. So it could create more jobs in areas with higher unemployment too.
Now, I suppose my question, Tony, is how do you actually go about as a government doing that?
Social care and energy efficiency as two examples. I think that will ultimately depend on making decisions around public investment. The benefit is doing those sectors as opposed to grand infrastructure projects, we can actually create those jobs relatively quickly. I still think we'd be talking months, probably next year, for most of that to be happening. And the immediate demand crisis is right now, which is again why I think doing something about labour costs now is most important. Then how do you match people to those jobs? It's about making sure that local government, local job centre plus offices, local colleges, training providers are resourced, but also importantly are expected to work together and given the means to work together and get that training provision, those training pathways in place. And that training piece, you know, we do that fairly well, actually, when we try sort of hard enough to do it. There are good models in the UK where we've been able to do that in the past.
What would be an example of an existing model that works?
Over the last few years, the main means has been something called sector-based work academies, which is a horrible name. But in effect, it's lining up between 6 and 12 weeks of pre-employment training that is employer-led, but delivered by a college or training provider, that is training for a specific job that exists. And then as part of that training, you then get a work experience placement and a guaranteed interview at the end. So yeah, we do a lot of this already. We just need to scale it and do more of it and do it better.
Okay, well, I've not come to this discussion entirely unarmed, so earlier, I asked Verla Miranda from the OECD to explain Denmark's youth guarantee. Now, that's a scheme under which people under the age of 25 years should receive a good quality offer of employment, continued education, apprenticeship or a traineeship within 4 months of becoming unemployed or leaving formal education.
The Danish youth guarantee is seen as the gold standard for many because it really pays a lot of attention to activating young people as quickly as possible. Now, those young people who already have a sufficient level of education and are basically ready for the labor market, they receive guidance and counseling to find a job linked to whether or not you receive benefits, right? So having regular meetings with the young person to encourage them to look for a job or to encourage them to enter the education system or to provide additional services when needed.
Tony Wilson, are you attracted by it? Is it something that we could implement here?
You know, we had a youth guarantee in the last recession, which guaranteed that any young person who was reaching long-term unemployment, the offer of a job or training place. I mean, stepping back, you know, 10 years ago in the last recession, it was estimated that the costs of youth worklessness were between 10 and 30 billion pounds in terms of lost economic and fiscal costs. And so the cost of delivering a youth guarantee should, if you can target it right and design it right, be significantly outweighed by the benefits of reducing long-term youth unemployment. The key, though, is around making sure that where possible, people are going into good quality permanent jobs, and that will be open market jobs for the most part. But where people can't do that, they're getting the help they need to move into, you know, for example, job creation schemes that then have the support to get into permanent work by the end of it.
Now, you talked there about good quality jobs. And one of the great discussions we've had as a country is based on a feeling that too many people have been forced to work in jobs that are too lowly paid and whose conditions are insufficiently stable. As a minister, I might want to know whether I now have an opportunity to do something, which is to try and gear us towards better, more stable jobs.
I think you do. I think there are some real challenges because, you know, we know that in any downturn, when there's lower demand and when companies have been hit quite hard, that there's going to be downward pressure on pay. And pay can't fall by much because, you know, many, many people in these jobs have been paid at or around the minimum wage already. So that means that then there'll be probably pressure on the hours that people can work and on other measures of job security and job quality. So what we want to avoid, clearly, is employers choosing not to create jobs at all, for example, by overregulating that part of the labour market. But on the other hand, you know, we definitely want to be trying to do more to make work more predictable, making work more secure, but also hopefully making work better as well. So trying to make sure that more employers are doing what kind of good employers do in supporting people in lower paid work.
One of the sort of long-term trends that we've had perhaps is employers and business sort of shifting risks that they take onto either individuals or the state. I mean, we saw that in the financial crisis in terms of financial risks, and we're seeing other aspects of it in this crisis. So, for example, moving workers onto sort of self-employed contractor status, that reduces risk for business. And in theory, those self-employed contractors are entitled to less support when they become unemployed. But in practice, the state steps in to help these things out. So I think we do need longer term to rethink the balance about who's facing certain risks and who's paying for them. But I think the best protection to workers being forced onto sort of contracts that they're not happy with is actually a tight labour market, is low unemployment, when workers have got a lot of choice. But as Tony said, when we're going into high unemployment situation, people are going to be inclined to think, well, any job is better than no job. And, you know, our focus will be really on the quantity of jobs rather than the quality of jobs.
Okay, I think I've established what you both think should happen and what you'd be advising the Minister for Employment to do. I'm going to stop being the Minister. I'm going to be just a presenter of a radio programme now and ask you for your expertise. I mean, you've both worked with government in the past. What do you think the government is actually going to do faced with this problem? Tony?
I'm expecting probably three things. First, I'm expecting that they will do something on reducing labour costs for employers, probably through employer national insurance, but it could be through some other kind of wage subsidy rebate scheme. So in other words, trying to boost aggregate demand in the short term, because, you know, the immediate problem is how we ride out the next few months when companies have taken a hammering over the last few months. They need to repair their balance sheets and we don't want them to be shedding labour now. Secondly, they're going to announce something on job creation. My fear is it's going to be big infrastructure projects and white elephants that will take years rather than months and will probably land when the labour market's booming rather than when it's contracting. But hopefully within that job creation, they'll be looking at some of those sectors and industries where we can create jobs more quickly. But thirdly, I really hope there's something in there which is more about these sort of active labour market policies and services that can help people who are out of work or at risk of losing work to get back into work quickly.
Alan?
Yeah, no, I agree with Tony that I think they will do things in those directions. I think my worry is slightly that they really won't be bold enough, that they're going to be too worried about deficits and debt and the public finances. And this is going to hold them back from what is, you know, is necessary, which are really very bold initiatives.
Alan Manning there with Tony Wilson. So what conclusion can we draw from this? Well, maybe that the post-pandemic priorities should be above all, that the young don't fall out of employment, and then to make sure the unemployed don't suffer financially for all our sakes. My thanks to Melanie Sims, Laura Gardner, Tony Wilson and Alan Manning. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Joe Kent and Beth Sagar-Fenton. The editor was Jasper Corbett and it was mixed by James Beard. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including ones on the search for a vaccine for coronavirus, China and the pandemic, and the psychological impact of lockdown. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.